Welcome back to Hoops HD, everybody. It is the off season. It is May, and we are here with a cast of about 3 million characters.
Any more breaking news, Chad? It's the off season. It's May.
All right, the buzzer is not working. I've not even figured that out because it is the off season. And I don't know how my computer works anymore. I've done these in a month, 2 months
Chad's
almost.
Coming out swinging tonight. Well,
I'm Chad Sherwood. To my sides up here, we've got David Griggs, who won't shut up, and David Dorman. The center square below me, Rocco Miller. Check him out also at bracketeer.org. To his sides, John Slica and Joby Fortson. Down in the bottom row, John Titel and back with us for the first time in a very long time on a podcast, Dr. Galen Clavio back with us. Galen, first of all, haven't seen you forever. How you doing down there?
You know, I like to stop in about once every leap year and see how things are going. But no, it's, you know, doing great. Happy to be back for at least a little bit tonight. And it's good to see all you gentlemen. It's nice to put voices to the email messages, you know?
Yeah. I'll tell you, we have the main topic we want to discuss tonight is what's going on with name, image, and likeness rules, which are changing, which are seeing, especially in football, accusations being thrown at across the board at everybody. And Galen, that's one of the reasons we wanted we asked you to come on tonight, because I know you've been paying a lot of attention to this and talking about it recently. And so I want to kind of throw things to you to start, and we can kind of run from there and let everyone contribute from there. And I don't know what's going to happen tonight. We'll just try to get through it.
Hey, you know, it's like a blind date. We'll just kind of explore as the evening goes along. No, but yeah, name, image, and likeness. It's funny. I was talking with a former student of mine, and he works in the journalism business, and was talking about name, image, and likeness as something that he's going to have to write a lot of stories on. And he's like, is there really that much in it? And my statement to him was, look, people are attracted right now to the tagline of NIL. But what you're really covering is the gradual professionalization of collegiate athletics. And that's essentially where it's at right now, is if you look at the way that things are lined up, if you look at, you know, the NCAA's inaction last year in putting any sort of guardrails up, essentially, except for very basic ones that were easily run over by enterprising boosters and, you know, folks in the corporate world who saw an opportunity. What you're seeing is what a lot of us thought you were going to see in this process, which is a previously suppressed and underground commercial marketplace for college athletes suddenly bursting through the surface and flowering at a rate that's somewhat like, it reminds me of kudzu. You know, it's just one of the, it's like a weed that you're not going to be able to, you know, back off at this point. It's just here. We're going to have to deal with it. You know, and I think what we're seeing at this point is a bunch of people in the NCAA, a bunch of people at, you know, some of the major schools, not all, but some, looking at this and saying, uh-oh, this is going to get out of hand real quick. It's already out of hand. And there's really not a good way to back it off at this stage, because as much as the NCAA and its member schools are talking about, oh, we're going to, you know, go after these collectives that have been paying players, you know, in exchange for their participating with a particular school, what exactly are you going to do at this point? There's not really a legal recourse that's going to stand up in court that's going to back a lot of this off. My advice to some degree to people is, I think we should just let the market settle itself, because right now there's a bunch of money being thrown around. Nobody really knows what the market value of an athlete is in these revenue sports. And I think that that will find itself eventually. What's not going to help is trying to throw a bunch of material in early on, or a bunch of restrictions that can't be enforced. That's only going to muddy the waters further.
Yeah. Galen, I know, again, you did a recent presentation that I actually snuck in to the room to observe recently about NIL and the
terrible
transfer.
Where I'm at. It's awful. Like, we couldn't keep Griggs out. It's just, anyway, yeah. Sorry.
Right. But one of the things that you brought up was the court cases, and I don't think the NCAA really decided to do this on its own. And a lot of people that are being critical of the NCAA for allowing this to happen are failing to realize that it was basically the courts that resulted in this. And when the Supreme Court, and I realize it wasn't an NIL case, but basically votes 9-0 and says that your amateur rules might be in violation of federal law, that's probably a good time to change what you're doing. And it was a lot of state legislatures that started passing laws that allowed for name, image, and likeness. So I just wanted to point that out. And B, I know this might be a loaded question. I kind of, from a legal standpoint, I'm not a lawyer. I know Joby is and Chad is. And like, while you aren't, you do sort of work in this world. Is name, image, and likeness a basic civil right? I would argue that it is.
Yeah, I think there's a real good argument, especially when you don't see that right encumbered for any other college student. And you know, I think the problem from a logical perspective for the NCAA and its member schools is that they've tried to have it both ways for decades, and they've largely succeeded in convincing the American public that somehow the small percentage of people that are on campuses on scholarship playing college athletics should have a different and frankly lesser version of rights to earn money off of their name and their likeness than a student that isn't an athlete. And that ultimately, from a logical perspective, I think just has never really been able to hold up long term. What they've, you know, essentially, I think, been able to do is continue to push the boundaries of what would be acceptable in the eyes of the public without it ever going to the courts and being decided. Like, you know, we've seen a lot of attempts on various aspects of things, whether it's, you know, unionization or whether it's some of these other things. And there's always been something that's blocked it getting to the point where there would be a deciding factor. And I think ultimately that's more wishful thinking on the part of collegiate athletic departments and the NCAA that represents them than anything else. In this case, you know, I talked about this in the presentation that you saw, David. I think everybody was fine with this until the mid-2000s, the aughts, as we would say, like 2004, 2005. Because at that point, even though there was a significant amount of money in college athletics, even though coaches are making a good amount of money, you didn't have the explosion of money that you saw from that point forward. And what that was television money coming into the college game, the foundation of the Big Ten Network, the foundation of the SEC Network, these huge triple-digit contracts being signed by ESPN and ABC, by Fox, by CBS. And as that ante continued to go up, you just look at the charts. Where did that money go? The money went to coaching salaries. The money went to expanding compliance offices. It went to building facilities, the whole gold plating aspect of college athletics. Well, what that didn't, I mean, at some point people looked at it and said, where's all this money going? And why is it still impossible to compensate athletes for what they're doing above and beyond just getting an education, which I always kind of laugh at being a college professor. There's a lot of reasons why that's always been a bit of a misnomer. So what you're saying, I think to some degree is correct, David, but I look at it as there were, much like Major League Baseball in the 1960s, when they kept denying players the ability to increase their overall compensation. They kept invoking the reserve clause. They kept saying, no, these are our rights. You're not allowed to any of this extra money. Eventually, it hit a point where it got to the courts and the walls got knocked down, and all of a sudden you had unfettered free agency. And that's essentially what we're looking at right now with name, image, and likeness. It's a really fascinating parallel 50 years later.
Yeah. Gail, let me throw one more question here, though. You mentioned these collectives and everything, and the NCAA tried to come out just a few weeks ago with this new guidance saying that we could treat these collectives as boosters, but I see zero way to enforce any of that. I mean, am I missing something with this new guidance, or was it just a bunch of words that meant nothing?
I think it's a bunch of words. Now, we have actual lawyers, including yourself, on the panel that might disagree with me. But my feeling is this. The NCAA has always relied on shame as its primary weapon, because it's not a legal body. It has no subpoena power. It cannot compel testimony except within the confines of the college game. The whole idea of the show cause penalty is, well, you're not going to go hire this coach because we're going to put the scarlet letter on them. Well, that's ineffective. We know that. Kelvin Sampson came back from that and, you know, made a Final Four with Houston. That's fine. Schools,
Larry
I think,
Brown has come back so many times. It'll make
yeah. Absolutely. I think we've gotten to a point where money is more important than reputation in college sports. I know people thought we were there before, but I really think we're there now. And the Miamis and the Texas A&Ms and these schools that are desperate for glory and tired of seeing their competition, who already has their own payment system for players. Like, this whole thing with Saban and Fisher over the course of the last week has been hilarious to me. Like, Saban acting like the, you know, doing the babe in the woods routine on this is hilarious when, you know, everybody knows, if you followed college sports, this is institutionalized. It never gets to the point where it's publicized. Talent doesn't just show up at Alabama because it really likes playing for Nick Saban. I'm sure they do, but there's a financial incentive for those players to be there as well. My argument's always been, let's just embrace that. There is a market for this. You go overseas, you look at 18-year-old athletes playing in European soccer, they're making, you know, decent amounts of money because they have a market value, and what they do actually matters to a lot of people. It matters from a media perspective, and that's where most of the money comes from. So, Chad, I think ultimately the NCAA thought they were going to come out with that announcement and school presidents and trustees were going to start quivering and be like, oh my God, the NCAA might punish us. And everybody was just kind of like, okay, yeah, bring it. Let's see what you got. And at this point, I don't think they got much.
Yeah. Let me ask for a couple other people here also for their opinions. Rocco, let me start with you. I mean, it sounds to me like, I think we've opened a Pandora's box almost with everything going on with the NIL, but is this a bad box to have opened? Maybe it's not a Pandora's box because that's evil. You know, maybe this is a box that we need to open and it should stay open.
Yeah, I mean, I think David pointed it out, you know, just a minute ago, where once the Alston case went 9-0 to a divided Supreme Court, the writing was on the wall for the NCAA that this is not something they can continue to kick down the road. I even think going back 5 years ago, we saw this coming and we didn't know exactly how it was going to shake out. Obviously, the NCAA, from my perspective, has just not wanted to deal with it for as long as absolutely possible. Let's just rake in as much revenue without paying others as we possibly can. And one of these years, they knew they were going to have to deal with it. They actually know that that's coming now with the announcement that Emmert is no longer going to be there by the end of this next year. And the other element of this that, and Galen, and you've done just a tremendous job of laying the groundwork here for this conversation, so I appreciate it. I agree with you on the market value being a good thing for the future. I do think player representation needs to be a big part of this because what's going on right now is players are way more educated than ever before. And that's only increasing as time goes on, even just month by month. So you look at, you know, the guys like John Ruiz made this public for those of us on the sidelines watching from afar on publicizing some of these salaries that the guys will be getting. But at the same time, that's actually really helpful because we start to get a sense of what's going on behind the scenes, and it's going to speed up the clock on decision makers and rule makers and an actual summit to come together. And I think a summit has to include that player representation because these players now are all doing groupthink. They have economists on their side that are telling them what they're worth. And the demands are just getting more and more because for all this time, there hasn't been a real way to quantify it. There hasn't been real time for athletes to set aside to take a hard look at this. Now there's actual, you know, I heard an interview with the Penn State quarterback, for example, a couple of weeks ago, and he's actually like leading the charge on NIL and running his own Zoom calls for all the other big time quarterbacks in college football. So this is like a mission. You know, I think he had a quote, my number one passion is football. My number two passion is NIL. And so this is only going to escalate further and further until there is a way to normalize it. And I think, you know, long story short there, there's enough money coming in, of course, from the college basketball tournament, but more so even in college football to go around and just need some responsible decision makers to call it what it is and to start building, like what Galen said, a fair market for it.
Yeah, I think it's a great set of points, Rocco. I look at the athletic department responses writ large to this as fear that money that was being donated to athletic departments for scholarships or other things is now going to going directly to players. Yeah. And that really scares a lot of athletic departments because they haven't operated in that environment before. But what you're saying is 100% correct, that there's opportunities to grow revenue streams. It's not simply a matter of a finite pie that there's only so many slices out of. You know, the college athletics has done many things that I have actively questioned over the 20 years or so that I've been looking at it professionally. But one of the things I've always, you know, had the hardest time with is you have a potential business here that could be very much expanded, could be capitalized on. You could capitalize on the popularity of your athletes. They could share in the profits, but you can also share in the profits. It doesn't just have to be a one-sided thing. There was an interesting note in that piece in The Athletic that I hope everybody read, that interview with Greg Shaheen from yesterday, where, you know, he mentioned And I mean, granted, this is Greg talking about Greg. So who knows how much of it's actually accurate, but I'll take it at face value for now, where it's like he approached the NCAA or, you know, when he was in it in the late 2000s, he's like, you know, we're leaving a lot of money, like $5, $10 million on the table by not licensing the video games. And they were like, well, you know, we can't do that because amateurism. And what a stupid thing to say and do. It's like it's how you argue amateurism out of one side of your mouth and negotiate, you know, $200 million television contracts out of the other is really quite a trick. And I think to some degree, the going back to the players thing, which I think is really important, Rocco, one of the big obstacles to player compensation or people getting together is that college athletes time out after, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever the sport might be, the really good ones, the ones that could push the marketplace, aren't there. Now that there's a marketplace, I think they have an opportunity to get together and set a course that not just they can follow, but also the people coming up through high school, who, by the way, also have market value and can start capitalizing on that in certain states.
In Texas, yeah.
Well, not yet. And Texas is having that. Texas is actually about to pass a bill to change their own high school rules. But I think that's where there's going to be some changes that'll be for the better, because I do think that, as you mentioned, players are getting some good advice. And I think you've got some smart college athletes out there who are going to be able to capitalize on that.
Something I want to throw out, I want to get basically everyone's opinion on it, including Galen's, because it's something that I think is really important that literally no one, at least in the media, has really discussed. And it's specific to basketball. As popular of a game as football is, the opportunities to continue playing after college are nowhere near what they are in basketball. Most people don't realize this, but over half of D1 players, not starters, but players, period, go on to sign professional contracts and earn more than $70,000 in that initial contract. And the number for the Power Five in Big East is actually over 80%. And one of the fears was a lot of the agents that want access to these players, and how do we keep them out, and what are they going to do, and they're going to backdoor them and have illegal contact, and we're going to lose eligibility at a crucial time. And with name, image, and likeness, I think that sort of got jacked up through the roof. And everyone's reaction, at least from what I could observe at every athletic department that I have connections to, which is somewhere around, more than one and less than 300, I'll just put it that way, was, well, we don't know what to do, so we're not going to do anything. So now the big fear, all these agents, all of the, are sort of, this. It's happening in these NIL deals, to where players are being introduced to agents that want contact with them later on. First, is this a problem at all, or was this just something that was imagined to be a problem because of what the amateur rules were? And secondly, like, what can be done about it if something should be done about it?
But who are you asking?
anybody in general.
I mean, I'll start. I'd like to welcome you all to the music industry, which is not, look, and I say that tongue in cheek, but in reality, this has been a problem in entertainment for a long time. You know, you get predatory people, agents, what have you, who look for young, talented people that they can exploit because they don't understand legalese. They don't read contracts. They're mostly just focused on that next big step. Now, we're very protective of our athletes here in the United States, like exceedingly protective of our athletes. We created an entire structure around them to try to protect them from these things. There's an argument to be made that we don't need to be doing that, that these are legal adults by the time they reach the age of 18. And, you know, I think the big issue here is if you're a college athlete, we have to stop thinking, if you're a college athletic department, stop thinking of your athletes as adversaries. You know, that was one of the things about the original NIL deals that I thought was peculiar, is if you're an athlete, you're basically treated like, okay, you can't use the marks and logos. You can't really rely on the athletic departments for advice on what to do, who to talk to, who not to talk to, who's a good actor, who's a bad actor. That doesn't have to be that way, but that's how it's initially been treated. And I think there's an opportunity here, which you don't see in the entertainment industry, for colleges to actually do what we do with a lot of our college students, and that is help to shepherd them through this particular era where they have a lot of talent, but they don't have a lot of worldly knowledge of how these things work, and put them in a position where we can give them advice, give them counsel, and you know, create a situation where they're not going to necessarily be exploited. You're going to have some exploitations in these circumstances, but it doesn't have to be that way.
Some schools like Florida State have taken that initial step, and I commend them for it.
They have. That's a good point, Joby. Like they discuss it, and they actually like have, if I'm not mistaken, sessions on what are questions you should ask when you're talking to agents before you decide on one. When should you talk to them? So
it's practically required coursework for them, which is good because just like you should have requirements, for a liberal arts degree, you should have basic knowledge of so that your life isn't ruined financially because of a bad decision you make at age 18.
Right. And it's a lot of things that, because very few of these players will play in the NBA. The ones that are going to, you almost don't have to worry about. But if you really do have a vested interest in the player's best interest, and you know that they're going to be playing overseas without maybe have never been overseas in their lives, and not knowing how the leagues work, and not knowing how the contracts work, and having to rely on an agent that knows how all of that works, but that may not have that player's best interest in mind, as Galen kind of alluded to, the possibility of exploitation is high, but at the same time, the possibility of compromising someone's eligibility, because technically it's still on the books, you're not supposed to talk to agents, but you can sign NIL deals. And what's happening now, and a lot of, at least the fear is, oh no, that they're not discussing agency, they're discussing an unrelated NIL deal, totally unrelated.
I'll tell you, Tytel, let me ask you, are you in favor of where we're going with all this? I mean, finally getting students, getting them compensated for the name, image, likeness, but really changing the way that college basketball was run, at least above the board. Forget about what was going on behind the scenes.
Well, I'm not in favor of it, but I'm an old school guy who figures that if you get your tuition and your books and your dorm, and you can be a god on campus because you are a god on campus, that's good enough. But again, I'm an old guy. So I just wanted to briefly talk about a guy Rocco mentioned, John Ruiz. So he's this billionaire Miami alum who's an attorney. I got to interview him a couple of weeks ago. The reason I haven't posted it yet is because if you think I'm posting something about a billionaire attorney without having him sign off on it first, you're crazy, but hopefully soon. So, to give you an idea, because part of me was wondering, like, what's in it for him? Because one of the motivations is that you get to pay good players to come to your school and help you do better on the field, on the court. I get that. I'm not in favor of paying them to do that, but that's a fair motive. That's an understandable market rate motivation. But the hidden one that I didn't realize, maybe I'm naive, is that, like, he's got all these companies. And so when he gets Nigel Pack to come over from Kansas State as the top transfer in the market and do a video about one of his companies, he gets like 5 million views the first day, which I don't know what the market rate value is of that, but I assume it's a lot. I mean, if I had video of like the puppet fighting Tim Miles at the border war, I couldn't get 5 million people to watch it, but this guy's got 5 million views.
Well, that's kind of what I was trying to say earlier, John, is that there is a real market value that most of us are too old to grasp. I teach a sports and social media class, and one of the things that we're talking about right now is the utilization of TikTok, Instagram, other, things that generally are only used by people regularly under the age of 30. The market there is entirely different from what we're used to. It's not television commercial based. It's not print ad based. It is social media based. It is all about engagement, and it's about having relevance to that particular age group. And I think for too long, and this is where I point the finger at a lot of people in media who should know better, the argument's been that college athletes don't have market value because all their market value is actually tied up in the schools that they're attending. And I've always thought that that's a silly argument because you can't uncouple the two. It's not like you can just put all on one. Yes, certainly Nigel Pack is owes some of his popularity to Kansas State, I guess. But realistically speaking, it's the guy's got a name and that name has some value, and you plug him into a market where you can get more out of that value, exploit, if you want to put it that way. I don't think it's necessary exploitation because he's getting paid a pretty good amount for that amount of views. I don't really see the problem with that. And that is the marketplace that's been suppressed essentially up to this point from a business perspective when it comes to college athletics.
And just to put in perspective, I thought I'd add, because I do this slightly for a living as well. If you get 5 million impressions for a targeted ad, if you're Procter & Gamble, et cetera, for that 5 million, that on the pay scale, rate scale on advertising, that's $150,000 value. Yeah. So just to put in perspective, he got $150,000 in what would the actual real internet market would be.
Norman, let me bring you in here also. I could get your thoughts on what we've been discussing here and the whole NIL situation.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Galen, I've listened to a lot of people speak on this issue, none as well and understandable as you have. So thank you very much. You put it in words that everyone can understand, and your points are really well taken. When I heard about this deal originally, and I see it today from the NCAA perspective, like Rocco said, they kicked the can down the street for years and years and years. And finally, they had to do something. But this was perfect for the NCAA. They don't have to come up with the money. They don't need to decide who's getting it. They don't need to decide which women on the track and field and the men on swimming and the football and the bat. They don't have to make any of these decisions. They don't have to come up with the money out of their pockets. This was perfect for the NCAA, as I see it, because it's not their money. All that TV money is staying right there. They don't have to give it to the kids. So if the agents get backdoored into these deals, man, who cares? Maybe, really? But the kids are not getting paid for me. So if I'm the NCAA, this works for me.
Salika, what do you think?
I'm thinking to one point that you had mentioned earlier when you're talking about name, image, and likeness also starting to pop up in the high school ranks, with Texas being one example. The state of Ohio and the Ohio High School Athletic Association was also exploring this topic, but for now, they're not going to, grant students into that pool right now. It's possible they may adopt a wait-and-see approach to places like Texas, Florida, California, wherever. But of course, there's also one other classic podcast that's sadly been lost to time, and that's Galen talking about the genesis of the student athlete and why, curiously, we have not heard him mention those two words in the same breath.
Yeah, it's, you know, here's the thing. You know, I tell my classes when I talk about this, I don't say the word student athlete. It's hard for me to even say them. I've kind of trained my brain to decouple them because, and I think most of our listeners would hopefully know this, but if they don't, that whole term was created by the NCAA to avoid paying out a workman's compensation claim to a football player that died in practice in the 1950s. You know, it's always been an effort by the NCAA to categorize college athletes as students and therefore not employees. You know, where I'm really interested about the trajectory of this is this Iowa legislation that was being bandied about. And I think there's something similar in California where it would actually classify college athletes as employees of universities, as opposed to this nebulous kind of quasi-student role that they currently operate in. And I'm interested to see what happens in that. Now, you know, I think what David talked about is accurate, in that this is actually kind of what the NCAA, if they were going to go to a de-amateurized model, would want, a model where they can keep all their revenue streams and not have to cut athletes in on the money. But I think, because, you know, I keep looking at this resistance and I'm like, I think you folks are actually about to blow it. Because if you push too hard back on this idea that athletes can have access to money regardless of where it comes from, we're not going to restrict, you know, the idea that, oh, you're going to restrict these collectives from doing X, Y, or Z because of amateurism or some, like, you know, some original idea, which that whole amateurism concept I think needs to go as well for, that's another podcast, frankly. If you get to that point, and you suddenly have states around the nation saying, hey, these are actually employees. They're not just students. They're serving a dual role. Now I think you do start to endanger the free flow of television money and the money that the NCAA and its member schools have been collecting, and the conferences for that matter. That's kind of the next frontier. We're at a point right now where you might be able to get some stasis and people might be happy. If you push back on that too much, I worry if that maybe breaks a different dam.
Galen, thank you. That is a big Rubicon that is sitting right in front of us. I'm glad you addressed it. It's one of the things that constantly I think about and talk about in this space. One element is NIL is very free market at the end of the day. If the star quarterback is paid differently than the backup tight end, no one walks into, except for the backup tight end's parents and maybe a couple of high school buddies, walks into the stadium to see them sit on the bench for 3.5 hours. The compensation that they get for that, as Lori Loughlin proved at USC, is worth $500,000, you know, because that's free market in a black market sense of paying to get your kid in through athletics. If the, $500,000 for that backup tight end, if that's what their entire career is, worth of education, that's a good deal, as John Titel pointed out. But maybe not so for the quarterback who's bringing in a lot more money. He deserves that NIL. So that's where I'm okay. I'm fine with NIL. But when we get to base, like some base minimum salary, the benefits that are, you know, retire IRAs, 401ks, and yeah, we start getting into the area that I think is a slippery slope. Now, the one thing from the legal side, and I'll try to keep this short, that I think we shouldn't overstep in reading the Ninos decision. Everybody gets fixated on the Kavanaugh concurrence.
Right.
Trust me on this. This has nothing to do with athletics. As someone who follows antitrust policy and antitrust law, Brett Kavanaugh will never write an opinion on antitrust because in a completely unrelated case, he diverged from Roberts on it. Assuming I'm getting inside the weeds a little bit, but with Ginsburg being replaced by Barrett, assuming Barrett holds traditional free market views on antitrust, Roberts or Gorsuch or someone like that will write will write decisions either 5-4 or Gorsuch will write a 9-0 decision, and it likely will not view unionization, you know, employment. That's why the case was actually narrowed to education benefits in the first place, I theorize. But will NIL be exploded and legalized? Yes, I think in a free market way, it will be. But don't hold breath on the unionization, on especially this Supreme Court granting unionization if there's any real fight. But of course, as the NCAA has already shown, ostrich is not the best strategy for fighting something.
Let me ask one other question here. Rocco, let me go back to you on this. Actually, with the whole NIL thing, don't we have to also look at it in the context of the new transfer portal rules where you can transfer freely? So are we not recently at a complete free agency at this point? I'll go to the school where I can get the best NIL deal.
Right. Yeah. And in basketball, I mean, we've already become accustomed to it. I think in the last 4 straight years, we've had over 1,000 players transfer, or at least enter the portal. The number goes up each year, and now football's really starting to feel it for the first real time. But I think all of this does get connected because, you know, if you start to establish a fair market value, if you start to establish, you know, some responsibility from all parties and players included, you then can start to have some real discussions, some real decisions can be made. Because right now, I mean, look at it. A lot of coaches I talk to, that, you know, they spend this time of year going to AAU tournaments, getting to recruit and scout, and they go after high school guys. None of them are doing that at the top 150 programs right now because they're all staying back to host transfers. And so they're not even going to the tournaments anymore. They're like, screw freshmen. We're just going to take transfers. And, you know, half the D1 programs are recruiting that way right this cycle. So there's a problem with it because right now, without a collective bargaining agreement in place, this is where you could actually start to negotiate some of these things in. You could then start to make some rules about a window of transfers like you have in professional soccer, for example. I think we'll need that for the two big sports here and probably all the other NCAA sports.
It's funny that you
Go ahead.
I was going to say it's funny you mentioned the transfer impact, Rocco, because when Fred Hoiberg took over at Iowa State, ESPN did a piece on this and that they were talking about him not wanting to go through a recruiting class of a freshman or junior college transfers. He just went straight to what was not the transfer portal back then, but he and his staff were just doing quick evaluations of who would be looking to come in. Now, this was also when you had to sit out a year and wait to be eligible to play, but they were a lot better than the team that Iowa State had initially put out, and that was one of the reasons why Hoiberg was successfully initially, but once that playing field leveled off, his record also leveled off, as you've seen at Nebraska the past few years.
Right, and that's a great point because, you know, Hoiberg was ahead of his years in doing that. Now, you know, not everybody has to do it, but at least 50% of the D1 programs, we're talking nearly 200 programs, are going to recruit this way. Because if you get it, like, take a look at, like, Kyle Smith at Washington State. He'll enter his third or fourth year this next year and hasn't made the tournament. Do you think he's going to go out and try to reload with five or six freshmen in a class? No way. Like, those type of guys, the amount of pressure, the amount of money in a Power 5 job, even out here in the Pac-12, dictates that you have to load up in the portal or at least have a nice mix of portal pieces with some returning players and maybe one or two, four or five star guys. And then that seems to be like the winning blend to get your program on the right track, not only to get into a tournament, but also build on for the season after. And the larger point is more just about having some set windows. So coaches are still able to go watch players in the spring and the summer. So they do have time to have visits. So players can have these windows to transfer. We also had situations last January and December where a leading scorer on a lower Division I team would stop playing and enter the portal because perhaps he got incentivized to leave. We even saw Oscar Tshiebwe himself leave West Virginia a couple of years ago, halfway through the year. So it even happened at the Power 5 level in that example. So I think everybody involved, players, coaches, administrators, leadership at the NCAA level are interested in creating this. And the only way we really get there is to have some sort of collective bargaining agreement where everybody comes to the table and makes responsible decisions after good discussion and owns up to the fact that there's a lot of money in this pot. We just got to figure out how to slice up a very large pie.
Is that where we're going, Tytel? We go into a collective bargaining agreement and lockouts and strikes and all the nonsense we get in, like, things like Major League Baseball. Are we getting that in college sports here?
I hope not. I mean, sticking in the Pac-12, I think that Tommy Lloyd came into a good situation last year. He had a couple transfer guys like Justin Kyer, but he had Mathurin and Coloco and Creasa and just, like, built from within. And I think that international recruiting is not something that's going to go the way of the dinosaur, because I think he proved it can work. I'm not an employment law attorney, so I don't have a great answer to your fair question. I certainly hope not. I mean, like, going back to Nigel Pack, like, he was rated the number one transfer on the market, which is why John Ruiz wanted to give him $800,000 and a car. But, like, do you know how many conference tournament games Nigel Pack has won in his life? One. Do you know how many NCAA tournament games or NIT games he's played in? Zero. He's a good player, but, like, if he's getting 800 grand, like, I don't know if I can count high enough for, like, a lottery pick kind of guy.
I remember SMU getting the football death penalty for cars being given to players, and that's how much the world has changed, I think, with all of this.
Well, and I mean, on another token, Tshiebwe is getting $2 million, right? So there you go. There's an example. And, you know, in some ways it's good for the game. Like, a guy like that dominant coming back to college basketball hasn't been possible in the last 20 years. So we can turn all this into a positive for the entertainment value and the fan bases. It's just got to be done the right way. And now that it's above the water, everybody's got to deal with it.
And Joby, I think this point that you wanted to make also kind of going back to the transfer issue though, but maybe, you know, we were 10 years ago, even so, you know, it was the way to recruit and build a basketball team was with the one and dones. And that's, you know, Coach K went to that. We saw that, you know, Kentucky. Is that now gone? Is now the way to build a college basketball team is get the best NIL deal so you can get the best transfers into your team and build it that way, in addition to the one and dones, and get, you know, just the way to build is to make sure the NIL deals are available at your school.
Yeah, for the big guys, it is, and not even the big guys. A perfect example, you know, one that hits close to home is a UVA guy. The number two, and since John follows recruiting, Tytel might be very familiar with this. By all accounts, the number two point guard in the out of Georgia, went to Malcolm Brogdon's high school in Georgia, blah, blah, was ready to UVA. UVA, you know, it was going to happen. It was perfect system, defense, you know, et cetera. And then out of nowhere, cut UVA, just dropped him on the day everybody thought he would announce to UVA. And by all accounts, he's going to go to Georgia now. And the reason why? NIL. It was open. It was UVA didn't bring enough to the table on NIL. And Georgia, which I think we can all agree is an ass backwards program, is likely to get him because of the SEC network and TV money. So it'll be very interesting to see if we see a tectonic shift to specifically the SEC and the Big Ten, since they have the largest revenue streams due to football. But will that bleed into other sports and then create, hey, Georgia gets a lot of players like him. Georgia's going to be really good really soon, even if you have people like Tom Crean coaching you. So, you know, the fact of the matter is, it's going to be very interesting to see how this shapes out on the whole landscape of college basketball.
Hey, Griggs, let me ask you, you and I are both big fans of what we call the under the radar schools. How do you see all this affecting the smaller schools? I mean, is this just going to be even more doom and gloom for them?
In the short term, the biggest impact is the amount of players that are leaving the schools. It's not unusual now for like Murray State, who was really good last year in the top 25 last year in the round of 32, got a 7 seed, would have been in on the first ballot clearly had they needed to be, had they not won the auto bid, lost their coach and literally their entire roster. St. Peter's is another one that, they were in position to return 5 of their top 6 players and really, you know, have something special this year. Their 6 top players left along with their coach. So I think the days of when you saw, I know that this is turning back the clock, but when Davidson went to the Elite Eight and then returned their entire roster the following year and was a media darling for a year, and VCU was for a while and Butler was, where having sustained success after becoming a national story or having some sort of, it's going to be hard to sustain success and build on it from year to year, because the second you get good, your top players are leaving, perhaps all your starters and key players. That's what it feels like.
Well, I think that Davidson Elite Eight was about some guy named Curry, but that might be another story.
Yeah,
I'm bad. Well, I tried to get he left, but he decided to come back. Crazy. Yeah. Won't see that very often.
But what do you think? I don't know. I think for the next few years, you're going to see high transfer rates continue. Is it going to level off or not?
Yeah, I think, Dorman, that's the big question. Every time we get somebody that does come up, like I'll give the Steph Curry example. Steph Curry shows up at Davidson. He has a great year. Well, here you go. Now, if you move to Duke, by the way, we've got this $10 billion NIL deal for you sitting here. Or you could stay at Davidson and keep having your picture on used car ads, you know.
I think the difference between the big boys and the under the radar is only going to get larger because of just what we talked about. The money at these bigger schools, at our power conferences, they have these coaches are going to spend their time lining up their NIL deals. And that's what they're going to spend a ton of time with the boosters and lining up deals to bring in prospective kids for the team. And they're going to take kids from other schools that just succeeded and they've seen them play good in the tournament or all regular season. And like you just said, Chad, that they could stay there for a $5,000 used car guy, or there's, you know, $150,000 coming in from the Porsche dealer. And it's a no brainer. And you got to, and I don't blame the kids. I don't. You got to take it while it's hot, but it's a rough situation. And I don't see the difference between the big boys and our under the radars getting any smaller, as I wish it would.
So, okay, I got a couple thoughts. I generally agree with the overall sentiment of both Dorman and Griggs here, but I also just to kind of look at it on the other end, you know, there's only a certain amount of guys that are going to play college basketball. All those guys want playing time. All right, so if you're not getting playing time at the big boys, the mid-majors and the under-the-radar, sorry, I should never call them mid-majors, the under-the-radar schools will benefit. You know, you look at what Wyoming was able to do. They took really good players from USC and UCLA. They're a top 40 team going into next year. UAB for two straight offseason has loaded up with Power 5 talented players, and they're going to be an NCAA caliber team. Whether they'll earn the bid or not will be close like it was last year, but they're doing it. North Texas is doing that. You know, so there are established programs. You know, St. Mary's doesn't have a transfer portal problem because there is a way to keep those kids happy. It doesn't always have to be public. But the money's always been there, whether it's public or private. And, you know, every program's different. It's tougher for coaches coming in. You have to be savvy. You have to work harder on the under the radar. That's always been the case going back forever. And that's still the case. But there's ways to win and there's ways to really work your ass off and put a winning team out there. But it's certainly not easy, but there are, it's not all doom and gloom for the under the radar is what I'm trying to say.
And I agree with that too.
I agree. The one thing the under the radar school should be able to do better than they have in the past actually is the seniors in high school. While these other top tier, top power programs are worried about the NIL deals, the boosters getting the money to their kids and the transfer portal, the freshmen might be there for the pickings for the under the radar schools. That's where they really could really could get ahead.
That's a great example. I have a great example. I just wrote about him yesterday. Winthrop lost DJ Burns, the Big South Player of the Year, to NC State. They had a huge void to fill. A big time center out of IMG Academy named Michael Moore had offers from the ACC, the SEC, the A10, and he committed to Winthrop because he's going to be their starting center next year as a freshman.
And there are only
perfect example.
Yeah, there's only so many minutes to go around, and kids are going to want playing time. And Tytel, you follow what happens with the NBA a lot, also, and kids turning professional. It will the NIL maybe decrease the amount of kids that want to jump to professional ranks because now you can make the money while still in college.
I think Oscar Tshiebwe, as Rocco said, has 2 million reasons to stick around in Lexington. Although I really thought that like the whole point of the G League was that guys like Darius Baisley or whatever would like jump and they get their money there. Now that we have this whole thing where you can get high six, if not low seven figures and still be in college. I mean, it depends. Like if you don't want to go to class, that's a separate issue. But like, I think Chad, you're right in that like there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of reasons for a kid to stick in school. Although I honestly don't know the motivation. Like, do you want to get your NBA career started as fast as possible so you can get that second contract? Or do you want to like have some loyalty to your future alma mater? Or do you just want to like get on the stage in March Madness? Or do you want to get on the NBA and sit on the bench and win a championship? Like, I don't know what the kid's motivation is.
I guess my kind of the point here was the motivation of I just need a paycheck because I grew up in a very poor family. I'm struggling. That's no longer going to be a motivation. And maybe we see more kids stick in school. There's only so many roster spots and there's a filter down, kind of circle back around to some of the under the radar program screens that we're kind of back to where we start.
Right.
Like Rocco's point
and it's still, it honestly spills all the way down to D3. Like you could keep the under the radar going under and under and under. And now you see a lot of D2 all-stars coming up to the low and mid majors and becoming studs in places like the Missouri Valley. That's becoming way more common than ever before.
I'll tell you what, I know Galen had to jump out for early, so we can't say goodbye to him, but I give him a chance for any final thoughts. But I think we've used up pretty much most of our time already. So at that note, I did want to run through each of you for any other thoughts on this topic or honestly anything else you want to discuss here that we didn't get a chance to discuss. Stalika, let me start with you.
I'll go ahead and start with the legend of St. Bonaventure basketball who recently passed away, and that was Bob Lanier. He was a center who led the Bonnies to their lone Final Four in 1970. His name is on the court. And in the NBA, he had also had a career with the Detroit Pistons and Milwaukee Bucks, where he was a perennial all-star. Got mentioned in the movie Airplane, but after he had retired, he had also become the NBA's ambassador, where he would spread the word globally for the game. So rest in peace, to the gentle giant.
Joby.
Yeah, one thing that we touched on a little bit was the transfer portal. There was one development, not in college basketball, but in football, that has a huge impact on the transfer portal, and not in a positive way, in my opinion. They recently changed the limitation. You're allowed to have 85 players on a roster, 25 per year. They waived the 25 per year because you had so many people transferring out. I'm not on board with this. And it's from the view of the student athlete, not because of the schools being able to replenish their rosters. There's 85. Come on, replenish your rosters. You have 25 a year to do that. But do simple math here. If you have 25 and you're having more come in, that means all of a sudden you have these huge, and you see it in basketball, and this is where the basketball hook is. You see more kids out there than there are spots. And the problem here is that most of the time we hear about, the high profile changes and say, oh, that's good, freedom. But most of the time these kids are runoff. Let's be blunt. Yeah. Most of the time they're runoff. And so what happens is the kid is not only stripped of his ability to play basketball, but when he enters that transfer portal, he's stripped in many cases of his ability for a free education and ability for a better life, regardless of his caliber of playing. He was offered that ability. I truly believe that if you're going to have a transfer portal, that if you're going to expand scholarships in football, if you're going to have it be a wild, wild west, we have to move to 4-year scholarship guarantees as part of the contract up front. You have to do that. And I'm sorry, schools, you're going to have to pony up. Now, of course, there's exception for criminal activity or academic standing. You know, the kid has to put up their own end of the bargain on the academic and the personal side. But beyond those rare exceptions, for the most part, for a kid who actually cares about this education, they should be feel good that, hey, if there is no spot, if there is no spot somewhere else, whether it be D3, Rocco, or et cetera, where I feel comfortable landing, you should be able to go back to your school and get that education just as it was promised to you when you left high school. Because otherwise, we're already seeing it, tons of kids without opportunity who now have an aimless hole in their life and not good for society writ large in each of these cases. I don't like it. I think NIL is not the issue here. It's getting the transfer portal better understood and more workable. And one way to help it is the guarantees that should be assured for the educational opportunities for these kids.
I agree with you completely, Joby, actually. Tytel.
So I'm happy to report that even though there's all this money going around, there's still some teams doing it the old way, but with a new twist. So I'm not sure if any of you heard, but earlier today, Louisville decided that they wanted to go after the number one ranked rising senior, whose name is DJ Wagner. If that last name sounds familiar, it's because his dad, DeJuan, was a great player at Memphis for a guy named John Calipari, who was recruiting DJ to Kentucky. And Louisville, coached by Kenny Payne, wants the number one recruit as well. And so instead of hiring his father, as we've seen many, many times in the past, to be on the staff to encourage the kid to go there, Kenny Payne took it up a notch literally and hired not his father, but his grandfather, Milt Wagner. Now, to be fair, Payne and Wagner played together at Louisville in 86 and won a national championship.
They were roommates, weren't they?
I think so, and have been friends for longer than some of us have been alive. So there is some connection there, but I just love the fact that instead of hiring the father of the kid, you hire the grandfather of the kid, although it's going to be tough because I don't know too many people who succeed when fighting Calipari one-on-one in a recruiting battle, but we'll see what happens.
Dorman.
I want to say happy retirement and thank you to Coach Jay Wright. I was never the biggest Villanova fan, but I really appreciate the culture that he built at Villanova. And when they say culture in college basketball now, it's what he built and he put together at Villanova. And people can say what they want. The Big East was in big trouble. Connecticut was leaving and coming and leaving, and Syracuse left, and they were in trouble. And by Jay Wright making Villanova a top-tier Final Four team every year, it kind of held the Big East together. They would have been in big trouble because they wouldn't have been having many premier programs and a lot of big wins outside of Villanova. So I really think Jay Wright helped the Big East. But obviously, he really helped Villanova, and he did a great job. And I think I had the pleasure of speaking with him once or twice, and he was just the utmost gentleman. And if he comes back, I really hope it's in college, but he was really great for the game.
I'll tell you, I would not be shocked if after a couple of years off, he's looking to get back in the game. I really would. It would, I'd shock me if that didn't happen. I'll put it that way. Rocco, let me go to you.
A good shout out there. In college football, you hear all the time when coaches are hired or, you know, they're happy in their job. They always talk about needing to have alignment from the president to the AD to the head coach to the entire football program. Well, I think that's under talked about in basketball as well. I think it's really important, actually. So, you know, the NIL stuff, I think that's all hand in hand. I think the majority of the SECs figured it out that they have, I think, probably the best crop of head coaches in the country. You could argue, at least, when you look at Musselman and Calipari and Pearl and all the new guys they just brought in, the best of the best of the under the radar. So, you know, at Washington, it's a little opposite. And there's some schools out here in the West that are slower, it seems like, with the NIL stuff. I think within the next couple of years, that will get right sized. But a school out East that is under the radar, that's got alignment figured out, is Coach Grasso and the Bryant Bulldogs. So this year, not only is he bringing in Doug Edert from St. Peter's, but Earl Timberlake, a big time player that's played for Memphis and Miami. Antoine Walker is coming over from Rhode Island, and Chauncey Hawkins and others. So he's got six new guys that are all probably good enough to be their second best player because they had Peter Kiss last year. But not only that, he's got a new conference. They're going to the America East Conference, and they're ready to do war with Vermont, who's had a longstanding stake in the ground as the dominant team. Obviously, UMBC's knocked them off a time or two, but it's going to be a ton of fun to watch Bryant and Vermont games this next year. So I just wanted to give Bryant a shout-out for all the hard work they've done to get to this point.
Yeah, great point here. And it's going to be a fun America East this season. I agree with you on that, too. Greg, you want to finish us off?
Yeah, just real quick, one of the things we talked about, the transfer portal, over a third of the players, there's roughly 4,500 D1 players. You figure that, like, you know, maybe 20% of those or less, around 20% are graduating. Over a third of the players that are eligible to return went into the portal. And I was a longtime supporter of the portal. I think that the main reason it's there is because compliance officers got sick of paperwork. I don't care what anyone says. I think that's the main reason why we have it. But whenever any organization, any business, even if it's any church, anything, any community is losing a third of its members every year, you're going to stop and ask yourself, what is it that's making so many people think they'd be happier somewhere else? And one of the reasons, I think one of the things that we might want to look at that we've never really thought of before is, what can schools do to make players happier in being there and maybe not want to go somewhere else? Because it is a basketball phenomenon. Other sports, they never had the year in residency rule. Basketball was one of only a few that did, and they don't have anywhere near the transfer rates even now that basketball has. What is it that's making so many people think they'd rather be somewhere other than where they are?
It's interesting. Maybe it's good debate for another time. I would say that there is a couple of things, though. That basketball is only five starters. Most of the sports have more starters than five, and obviously the NIL being the big factor now. But I think I think we've gone far enough today. We're a little over time as it is. So on that note, I do want to thank everyone for joining us on behalf of David Dorman and John Sleek up here, Joby Fortson in the center square there, Rocco Miller, John Titel to his sides, David Griggs down below, and Galen Clavio, who was with us for about the first half of the show. I'm Chad Sherwood. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be talking to you again sometime next month.